James Irvin Sr. established a ferry here in 1755, the same year his son James Jr. was born at their home on the far side of the river. What looks like a very wide ditch uphill of the trail bridge, with high banks on either side like a creek, is the northern access road for the ferry. The ferry was probably a flat-bottomed wooden boat or barge wide enough to carry a wagon, attached via loops to a rope that was secured to trees or posts on both banks to keep the boat from drifting downstream. By 1781, James Jr. and his two brothers had taken it over, along with the land. Some modern sources and signs call this Irwin's Ferry because Green did in his letters, but he got it wrong. James filed many claims with the new Commonwealth of Virginia to be paid for ferry crossings related to the war and for meat, grain, and pastures for horses. The ferry boat is not alone today, a cold, drizzly Wednesday, February 14, 1781. Probably crowded on the far side are several others, either large rowboats or perhaps more flat-bottomed barges like the ferry boat. With them on that side is the man in charge, Lieutenant Colonel Edward Carrington, Greene's Quartermaster General, Chief Supply Officer. Carrington lived in this region, but was in Hillsborough, North Carolina, the prior October when Greene passed through on the way to taking over the Southern Continental Army. Greene ordered Carrington to survey the Dan as a possible supply route. Carrington wrote Greene later that he had a man canoe up the river to do so. In the war council at Guilford, Carrington told Greene there was a ferry near today's Danville, Virginia, but Cornwallis was about as close to that as the Continentals were. Carrington reported there were only four other large boats between that one and Boyd's Ferry and suggested gathering all to cross here and at Boyd's instead. A militia unit was sent ahead to collect the boats and maybe store them somewhere upstream so they would not give away the planned location for the crossing. Now most are probably in the river below you, though it is possible one or more were sent to Boyd's to join the ferry boat there. Depending on the time of year, you may get a better view of the riverbank and bottomlands a little further down the trail. Finally, around midday on the 14th, the first of the Continentals arrive and flow down the opposite side into the ferry and nearest boats. The wagons are sent across first, the last arriving on this side around 2 p.m. Then the men, numbering around 900, begin to cross. Almost all are regular Army soldiers from Delaware, Maryland, and Virginia, including dozens of African Americans. Only about 80 of the part-time soldiers called militia came with them, of the roughly 1,000 with the Army just 5 days earlier. No records leave an exact description of the crossing. Lieutenant Colonel Light Horse Henry Lee hints in his memoir that multiple boats could leave at once. Perhaps as the first boats clear the far bank full of soldiers, others move into place, more men file in, and a ballet of boats dances before you. On this side, the men flow uphill into the woods and set up a temporary tentless camp alongside the road. Greene writes Williams at 4 p.m., "I have not slept 4 hours since you left me, so great has been my solicitude to prepare for the worst." Finally, at 5:12, he writes again, "All our troops are over and the stage is clear." When Williams gets the message and informs his troops, they cheer so loudly that the nearby British hear them. Williams' corps had been faking as if headed to Dick's Ferry near modern Danville, 25 miles upstream from Irvin's, to your right when facing the river. After allowing what he hoped was enough time for the main army to escape, Williams had turned directly this way. Lee's cavalry trailed behind to protect the foot soldiers. Greene orders Williams to send his infantry here to cross over. Lee was to cross at Boyd's Ferry. Greene posts artillery on this bank facing across, and some troops get behind earthworks thrown up by men sent ahead. Remains were still visible on this side into the early 1900s. More soldiers are on the other side, possibly behind more earthworks, ready to defend against the British if they show up before the Light Corps can escape. The Light Corps arrives just before sunset, perhaps 45 minutes after Greene's order was sent. In 24 hours, Williams' 100 men had marched 40 miles. The crossing process restarts, continuing into the moonless night by torch or firelight. Perhaps never getting his orders, Lee arrives here as the last of the infantry reaches this side. Carrington tells him to have the horses swim across. Some flee in fear, but are rounded up and pushed into the dark water. Not until 9 p.m. do Carrington and Lee cross over in the last boat, Lee says. Carrington orders any boats still on the far side brought to this one and secured to trees. After the war, Carrington served in the Continental Congress and was the jury foreman in the treason trial of Aaron Burr, who had killed Alexander Hamilton in a pistol duel. Please scroll down to the audio clip under "The British Fail Again."